and the smooth cream of her skin. "Sweetling," he called her. "And who is this?" The singer raised his eyes. "I am called Simon Silvertongue, my lord, a player, a singer, a tale-teller."
"And a great fool," Tyrion finished.
"What did you call me when I entered?"
"Call? I only..."
The silver in Simon's tongue seemed to have turned to lead.
"My lord, Hand, I said an honour..."
"A wiser man would have pretended not to recognise me. Not that I would have been fooled, but you ought to have tried. What am I to do with you now, eh? You know of my sweet Shay. You know where she dwells. You know that I visit by night alone.
I swear I'll tell no one."
"On that much we agree. Good night to you." Tyrion led Shay up the stairs. "My singer may never sing again now," she teased. "You've scared the voice from him. A little fear will help him reach those high notes." She closed the door to their bedchamber. "You won't hurt him, will you?" She lit a scented candle and knelt to pull off his boots. "His songs cheer me on the nights you don't come." "Would that I could come every night," he said, as she rubbed his bare feet. "How well does he sing?"
"Well, better than some. Not so good as others."
Tyrion opened her robe and buried his face between her breasts. She always smelled clean to him, even in this reeking sty of a city. "Keep him if you like, but keep him close. I won't have him wandering the city spreading tales in potshops." "He won't," she started. Tyrion covered her mouth with his own. He'd had talk enough. He needed the sweet simplicity of the pleasure he found between Shay's thighs. Here, at least, he was welcome, wanted. Afterward, he eased his arm from under her head, slipped on his tunic, and went down to the garden. A half-moon silvered the leaves of the fruit trees and shone on the surface of the stone bathing pond. Tyrion seated himself beside the water. Somewhere off to his right, a cricket was chirping, a curiously homey sound.
"It is peaceful here," he thought. "But for how long?"
A whiff of something rank made him turn his head. Shay stood in the door behind him, dressed in the silvery robe he'd given her. "I loved a maid as white as winter, with moon glow in her hair." Behind her stood one of the begging brothers, a portly man in filthy patch robes, his bare feet crusty with dirt. A bowl hung about his neck on a leather thong where a septon would have worn a crystal. The smell of him would have gagged a rat.
"Lord Varys has come to see you," Shay announced.
The begging brother blinked at her, astonished. Tyrion laughed.
"To be sure. How is it you knew him when I did not?"
She shrugged.
"It's still him, only dressed different."
"A different look, a different smell, a different way of walking," said Tyrion. "Most men would be deceived."
"And most women, maybe, but not whores. A whore learns to see the man, not his garb. Or she turns up dead in an alley."
Varys looked pained, and not because of the four scabs on his feet. Tyrion chuckled. "Shay, would you bring us some wine?" He might need a drink. Whatever brought the eunuch here in the dead of night was not like to be good.
"I almost fear to tell you why I've come, my lord," Varys said when Shay had left them. "I bring dire tidings."
"You ought to dress in black feathers, Varys. You're as bad an omen as any raven."
Awkwardly, Tyrion pushed to his feet, half afraid to ask the next question. "Is it Jaime? If they have harmed him, nothing will save them."
"No, my lord, a different matter. Sir Courtenay Penrose is dead. Storm's End has opened its gates to Stannis Baratheon."
Dismay drove all other thoughts from Tyrion's mind. When Shay returned with the wine, he took one sip and flung the cup away to explode against the side of the house. She raised a hand to shield herself from the shards as the wine ran down the stones in long fingers, black in the moonlight.
"Damn him!"
Tyrion said.
Varys smiled, showing a mouthful of rotted teeth. "Who, my lord, Sir Courtenay or Lord Stannis?"
"Both of them."
Storm's End was strong. It should have been able to hold out for half a year or more, time enough for his father to finish with Robb Stark.
"How did this happen?"
Varys glanced at Shay. "My lord, must we trouble your sweet lady's sleep with such grim and bloody talk?"
"A lady might be afraid," said Shay, "but I'm not."
"You should be," Tyrion told her. "With Storm's End fallen, Stannis will soon turn his attention toward King's Landing." He regretted flinging away that wine now. "Lord Varys, give us a moment, and I'll ride back to the castle with you."
"I shall wait in the stables," he bowed and stomped off.
Tyrion drew Shay down beside him. "You are not safe here."
"I have my walls and the guards you gave me."
"Sell swords," Tyrion said. "They like my gold well enough, but will they die for it? As for these walls, a man could stand on another's shoulders and be over in a heartbeat. A manse, much like this one, was burned during the riots. They killed the goldsmith who owned it for the crime of having a full larder, just as they tore the High Septon to pieces, raped Lullies 50 times, and smashed the Aaron's skull in. What do you think they would do if they got their hands on the Hand's Lady?"
"The Anne's whore, you mean?"
She looked at him with those big, bold eyes of hers.
"Though I would be your lady, my lord. I'd dress in all the beautiful things you gave me, in satin and samite and cloth of gold, and I'd wear your jewels and hold your hand and sit by you at feasts. I could give you sons, I know I could, and I vow I'll never shame you."
"My love for you shames me enough." "A sweet dream, Shay. Now, put it aside, I beg you, it can never be."
"Because of the Queen? I'm not afraid of her, either."
"I am."
"Then kill her and be done with it. It's not as if there was any love between you."
Tyrion sighed. "She's my sister. The man who kills his own blood is cursed forever in the sight of gods and men. Moreover, whatever you and I may think of Cersei, my father and brother hold her dear. I can scheme with any man in the Seven Kingdoms, but the gods have not equipped me to face Jaime with swords in hand."
"The young wolf and Lord Stannis have swords, and they don't scare you."
"How little you know, sweetling. Against them I have all the power of Haas Lannister. Against Jaime or my father, I have no more than a twisted back and a pair of stunted legs."
"You have me."
Shay kissed him, her arm sliding around his neck as she pressed her body to his. The kiss aroused him, as her kisses always did, but this time Tyrion gently disentangled himself. "Not now, sweetling. I have, well, call it the seed of a plan. I think I might be able to bring you into the castle kitchens." Shay's face went still.
"The kitchens?"
"Yes, if I act through Varys, no one will be the wiser." She giggled.
"My lord, I'd poison you. Every man who's tasted my cooking has told me what a good whore I am."
"The Red Keep has sufficient cooks, butchers and bakers too. You need to pose as a scullion."
"A pert girl," she said, "in scratchy brown rough spun. Is that how my lord wants to see me?"
"My lord wants to see you alive," Tyrion said. "You can scarcely scour putts in silk and velvet."
"Has my lord grown tired of me?"
She reached a hand under his tunic and found his cock. In two quick strokes she had it hard.
"He still wants me," she laughed. "Would you like to fuck your kitchen wench, my lord? You can dust me with flour and suck gravy off my titties if you—"
"Stop it!" The way she was acting reminded him of Dancy, who had tried so hard to win her wager. He yanked her hand away to keep her from further mischief. "This is not the time for bed sport, Shay. Your life may be at stake." Her grin was gone.
"If I've displeased my lord, I never meant it. Only, couldn't you just give me more guards?" Tyrion breathed a deep sigh. Remember how young she is, he told himself. He took her hand. Your gems can be replaced, and new gowns can be sewn twice as lovely as the old. To me, you're the most precious thing within these walls. The Red Keep is not safe either, but it's a deal safer than here. I want you there. In the kitchens, a voice was flat, scouring pots. For a short while. My father made me his kitchen wench, she said, her mouth twisting. That was why I ran off. You told me you ran off because your father made you his whore, he reminded her. That too. I didn't like scouring his pots no more than I liked his cock in me. She tossed her head. Why can't you keep me in your tower? Half the lords at court keep bed warmers. I was expressly forbidden to take you to court. By your stupid father, Shay pouted. You're old enough to keep all the horns you want. Does he take you for a beardless boy? What could he do? Spank you? He slapped her. Not hard, but hard enough. Damn you, he said. Damn you. Never mock me. Not you. For a moment, Shay did not speak. The only sound was the cricket, chirping, chirping. Beg pardon, my lord, she said at last, in a heavy wooden voice. I never meant to be impudent. And I never meant to strike you, gods be good, am I turning into Cersei? That was ill done, he said. On both our parts. Shay, you do not understand. Words he had never meant to speak came tumbling out of him like mummers from a hollow horse. When I was 13, I wed a crofter's daughter, or so I thought her. I was blind with love for her, and thought she felt the same for me, but my father rubbed my face in the truth. My bride was a whore Jamie had hired to give me my first taste of manhood. And I believed all of it, fool that I was. To drive the lesson home, Lord Tywin gave my wife to a barracks of his guardsmen to use as they pleased, and commanded me to watch and to take her one last time after the rest were done. One last time, with no trace of love or tenderness remaining. So you will remember her as she truly is, he said. And I should have defied him, but my cock betrayed me, and I did as I was bid. After he was done with her, my father had the marriage undone. It was as if we had never been wed, the Septon said. He squeezed her hand. Please, let's have no more talk of the Tower of the Hand. You will be in the kitchens only a little while. Once we're done with Stannis, you'll have another manse and silks as soft as your hands. Shay's eyes had grown large, but he could not read what lay behind them. My hands won't be soft if I clean ovens and scrape plates all day. Will you still want them touching you when they're all red and raw and cracked from hot water and lye soap? More than ever, he said. When I look at them, they'll remind me how brave you were. He could not say if she believed him. She lowered her eyes. I'm yours to command, my lord. It was as much acceptance as she could give tonight. He saw that plain enough. He kissed her cheek where he'd struck her to take some sting from the blow. I will send for you. Varys was waiting in the stables, as promised. His horse looked spavined and half dead. Tyrion mounted up. One of the sellswords opened the gates. They rode out in silence. Why did I tell her about Tysha? God's help me, he asked himself, suddenly afraid. There were some secrets that should never be spoken, some shames a man should take to his grave. What did he want from her? Forgiveness? The way she had looked at him, what did that mean? Did she hate the thought of scarring pots that much? Or was it his confession? How could I tell her that? and still think she would love me, part of him said, and another part mocked, saying, fool of a dwarf, it's only the gold and jewels the whore loves. His scarred elbow was throbbing, jarred every time the horse set down a hoof. Sometimes he could almost fancy he heard the bones grinding together inside. Perhaps he should see a maester, get some potion for the pain. But since Pycelle had revealed himself for what he was, Tyrion Lannister mistrusted the maesters. The guards only knew who they were conspiring with, or what they had mixed in those potions they gave you. Varys, he said, I need to bring Shae into the castle without Cersei becoming aware. Briefly, he sketched out his kitchen scheme. When he was done, the eunuch made a little clucking sound.
I will do as my lord commands, of course, but I must warn you, the kitchens are full of eyes and ears. Even if the girl falls under no particular suspicion, she will be subject to 1,000 questions. Where was she born? Who were her parents? How did she come to King's Landing? The truth will never do, so she must lie, and lie, and lie. He glanced down at Tyrion. And such a pretty young kitchen wench will incite lust as well as curiosity. She will be touched, pinched, patted, and fondled. Potboys will crawl under her blankets of a night. Some lonely cook may seek to wed her. Bakers will knead her breasts with floured hands.
I'd sooner have her fondled than stabbed, said Tyrion. Varys rode on a few paces and said,
It might be that there is another way. As it happens, the maidservant who attends Lady Tander's daughter has been filching her jewels. Were I to inform Lady Tander, she would be forced to dismiss the girl at once, and the daughter would require a new maidservant.
I see. This had possibilities, Tyrion saw at once. A lady's bedmaid wore finer garb than a scullion, and often even a jewel or two. Shae should be pleased by that. And Cersei thought Lady Tander tedious and hysterical, and Lollies a bovine lackwit. He was not like to pay them any friendly calls.
Lollies is timid and trusting, Varys said. She will accept any tale she is told. Since the mob took her maidenhead, she is afraid to leave her chambers, so Shae will be out of sight, but conveniently close, should you have need of comfort.
The Tower of the Hand is watched, you know as well as I. Cersei would be certain to grow curious if Lolly's bedmaid started paying me calls.
I might be able to slip the child into your bedchamber unseen. Shatayas is not the only house to boast a hidden door.
A secret access? To my chambers? Tyrion was more annoyed than surprised. Why else would Maegar the Cruel have ordered death for all the builders who had worked on his castle, except to preserve such secrets?
Yes, I suppose there would be. Where will I find the door? In my solar? My bedchamber? My friend, you would not force me to reveal all my little secrets, would you?
Henceforth think of them as our little secrets, Varys. Tyrion glanced up at the eunuch in his smelly mummer's garb. Assuming that you are on my side.
Can you doubt it?
Why, no, I trust you implicitly. A bitter laugh echoed off the shuttered windows. I trust you like one of my own blood, in truth. Now tell me how Courtney Penrose died.
It is said that he threw himself from a tower.
Threw himself? No, I will not believe that.
His guards saw no man enter his chambers, nor did they find any within afterward.
Then the killer entered earlier and hid under the bed, Tyrion suggested, or he climbed down
from the roof on a rope. Perhaps the guards are lying. Who's to say they did not do the thing themselves?
Doubtless you are right, my lord.
His smug tone said otherwise. But you do not think so. How was it done, then?
For a long moment, Varys said nothing. The only sound was the stately clack of horseshoes on cobbles. Finally, the eunuch cleared his throat.
My lord, do you believe in the old powers?
Magic, you mean? Tyrion said impatiently.
Blood spells, curses, shape-shifting, those sort of things?
He snorted.
Do you mean to suggest that Sir Courtney was magic to his death?
Sir Courtney had challenged Lord Stannis to single combat on the morning he died. I ask you, is this the act of a man lost to despair? Then there is the matter of Lord Renly's mysterious and most fortuitous murder, even as his battle lines were forming up to sweep his brother from the field.
The eunuch paused a moment.
My lord, you once asked me how it was that I was cut.
I recall, said Tyrion. You did not want to talk of it.
Nor do I. But
this pause was longer than the one before, and when Varys spoke again, his voice was different somehow.
I was an orphan boy, apprenticed to a travelling folly. Our master owned a fat little cog, and we sailed up and down the narrow sea, performing in all the free cities, and from time to time in Old Town and King's Landing. One day, at Myr, a certain man came to our folly. After the performance, he made an offer for me that my master found too tempting to refuse. I was in terror. I feared the man meant to use me as I had heard men use small boys. But in truth, the only part of me he had need of was my manhood. He gave me a potion that made me powerless to move or speak, yet did nothing to dull my senses. With a long hooked blade, he sliced me root and stem, chanting all the while. I watched him burn my manly parts on a brazier. The flames turned blue, and I heard a voice answer his call, though I did not understand the words they spoke. The mummers had sailed by the time he was done with me. Once I had served his purpose, the man had no further interest in me, so he put me out. When I asked him what I should do now, he answered that he supposed I should die. To spite him, I resolved to live. I begged, I stole, and I sold what parts of my body still remained to me. Soon I was as good a thief as any in Myr, and when I was older, I learned that often the contents of a man's letters are more valuable than the contents of his purse. Yet I still dream of that night, my lord, not of the sorcerer, nor his blade, nor even the way my manhood shriveled as it burned. I dream of the voice from the flames. Was it a god, a demon, some conjurer's trick? I could not tell you, and I know all the tricks. All I can say for a certainty is that he called it, and it answered. And since that day, I have hated magic and all those who practice it. If Lord Stannis is one such, I mean to see him dead.
When he was done, they rode in silence for a time. Finally, Tyrion said,
"A harrowing tale. I'm sorry."
The eunuch sighed.
You are sorry, but you do not believe me. No, my lord, no need to apologize. I was drugged and in pain, but it was a very long time ago, and far across the sea. No doubt I dreamed that voice. I've told myself as much 1,000 times. I believe in steel swords, gold coins, and men's wits, said Tyrion. And I believe there once were dragons. I've seen their skulls, after all. Let us hope that that is the worst thing you ever see, my lord. On that we agree, Tyrion smiled. And for Sir Courtney's death, well, we know Stannis hired cell sails from the free cities. Perhaps he bought himself a skilled assassin as well. A very skilled assassin. There are such. I used to dream that one day I'd be rich enough to send a faceless man after my sweet sister. Regardless of how Sir Courtney died, said Varys, he is dead. The castle fallen. Stannis is free to march. Any chance we might convince the Dornish men to descend on the marches? Asked Tyrion. None. A pity. Well, the threat may serve to keep the marcher lords close to their castles, at least. What news of my father? If Lord Tywin has won across the Red Fork, no word has reached me yet. If he does not hasten, he may be trapped between his foes. The Oakheart Leaf and the Rowan Tree have been seen north of the Mander. No word from Littlefinger? Perhaps he never reached Bitter Bridge, or perhaps he's died there. Lord Tarly has seized Renly's stores and put a great many to the sword, Florence chiefly. Lord Caswell has shut himself up in his castle. Tyrion threw back his head and laughed. Varys reined up, nonplussed. My lord? Don't you see the jest, Lord Varys? Tyrion waved a hand at the shuttered windows at all the sleeping city. Storm's End is fallen, and Stannis is coming, with fire and steel, and the guards alone know what dark powers. And the good folk don't have Jaime to protect them, nor Robert, nor Renly, nor Rhaegar, nor their precious Knight of Flowers. Only me, the one they hate. He laughed again. The dwarf, the evil counsellor, the twisted little monkey demon. I'm all that stands between them and chaos.
Catelyn. Rob bid farewell to his young queen thrice. Once in the guard's wood before the heart tree, in sight of guards and men. The second time beneath the portcullis, where Jane had sent him forth with a long embrace and a longer kiss, and finally, an hour beyond the tumblestone, when the girl came galloping up on a well-lathered horse to plead with her young king to take her along. Rob was touched by that, Catelyn saw, but abashed as well. The day was damp and grey, a drizzle had begun to fall, and the last thing he wanted was to call a halt to his march, so that he could stand in the wet and console a tearful young wife in front of half his army. He speaks her gently, she thought, as she watched them together, but there is anger underneath. All the time the king and queen were talking, grey wind prowled around them, stopping only to shake the water from his coat and bare his teeth at the rain. When at last Rob gave Jane one final kiss, dispatched 12 men to take her back to River Run, and mounted his horse once more, the direwolf raced off ahead as swift as an arrow loosed from a longbow.
"Queen Jane has a loving heart, I see," said lame Lothar Frey to Catelyn. "Not unlike my own sisters. Why, I would wager a guess that even now Rosalind is dancing around the twins, chanting, Lady Tolly, Lady Tolly, Lady Rosalind Tolly. By the morrow she'll be holding swatches of river run red and blue to her cheek to picture how she'll look in her bride's cloak."
He turned in the saddle to smile at Edmure.
"But you are strangely quiet, Lord Tully. How do you feel, I wonder?"
"Much as I did at the stone mill just before the war horn sounded," Edmure said, only half in jest. Lothar gave a good-natured laugh.
"Let us pray your marriage ends as happily, my lord."
"And may the gods protect us if it does not." Catelyn pressed her heels into her horse, leaving her brother and lame Lothar to each other's company. It had been her who had insisted that Jane remain at River Run, when Rob would sooner have kept her by his side. Lord Walder might well construe the Queen's absence from the wedding as another slight. Yet her presence would have been a different sort of insult, salt in the old man's wound. "Walder Frey has a sharp tongue and a long memory," she had warned her son. "I do not doubt that you are strong enough to suffer an old man's rebukes as the price of his allegiance, but you have too much of your father in you to sit there while he insults Jane to her face." Rob could not deny the sense of that. "Yet all the same, he resents me for it," Catelyn thought wearily. "He misses Jane already, and some part of him blames me for her absence, though he knows it was good counsel." Of the six Westerlings who had come with her son from the crag, only one remained by his side, Sir Reynold, Jane's brother, the royal banner-bearer. Rob had dispatched Jane's uncle, Rolf Spicer, to deliver young Martin Lannister to the Golden Tooth the very day he received Lord Tywin's assent to the exchange of captives. It was deftly done. Her son was relieved of his fear for Martin's safety. Gorbert Glover was relieved to hear that his brother, Robert, had been put on a ship at Duskendale. Sir Rolf had important honourable employment, and Grey Wind was at the king's side once more, where he belongs. Lady Westerling had remained at River Run with her children, Jane, her little sister Elena, and young Rollam, Rob Squire, who complained bitterly about being left. Yet that was wise as well. Oliver Frey had squired for Rob previously, and would doubtless be present for his sister's wedding. To parade his replacement before him would be as unwise as it was unkind. As for Sir Reynold, he was a cheerful young knight who swore that no insult of Walder Frey's could possibly provoke him. And let us pray that insults are all we need to contend with. Catelyn had her fears on that score, though. Her lord father had never trusted Walder Frey after the Trident, and she was ever mindful of that. Queen Jane would be safest behind the high, strong walls of River Run, with a black fish to protect her. Rob had even created him a new title, Warden of the Southern Marches. Sir Brynden would hold the Trident if any man could. All the same, Catelyn would miss her uncle's craggy face, and Rob would miss his counsel. Sir Brynden had played a part in every victory her son had won. Gorbert Glover had taken command of the scouts and outriders in his place. A good man, loyal and steady, but without the black fish's brilliance. Behind Glover's screen of scouts, Rob's line of march stretched several miles. The Great John led the van. Catelyn travelled in the main column, surrounded by plodding war horses with steel-clad men on their backs. Next came the baggage train, a procession of wains laden with food, fodder, camp supplies, wedding gifts, and the wounded too weak to walk, under the watchful eye of Sir Wendell Manderley and his White Harbour knights. Herds of sheep and goats and scrawny cattle trailed behind, and then a little tale of footsore camp followers. Even farther back was Robin Flint and the rear guard. There was no enemy in back of them for hundreds of leagues, but Rob would take no chances. 3,500 they were, 3,500 who had been blooded in the Whispering Wood, who had reddened their swords at the Battle of the Camps, at Ox Cross, Ashmark, and the Crag, and all through the gold-rich hills of the Lannister West. Aside from her brother Edmure's modest retinue of friends, the lords of the Trident had remained to hold the riverlands while the king retook the north. Ahead awaited Edmure's bride and Rob's next battle. And for me, two dead sons, an empty bed, and a castle full of ghosts. It was a cheerless prospect. Brienne, where are you? Bring my girls back to me, Brienne. Bring them back, safe. The drizzle that had sent them off turned into a soft, steady rain by midday and continued well past nightfall. The next day, the Northmen never saw the sun at all, but rode beneath leaden skies with their hoods pulled up to keep the water from their eyes. It was a heavy rain, turning roads to mud and fields to quagmires, swelling the rivers and stripping the trees of their leaves. The constant patter made idle chatter more bother than it was worth, so men spoke only when they had something to say, and that was seldom enough.
"We are stronger than we seem, my lady," Lady Mage Mormont said as they rode. Catelyn had grown fond of Lady Mage and her eldest daughter, Daisy. They were more understanding than most in the matter of Jaime Lannister she had found. The daughter was tall and lean, the mother short and stout, but they dressed alike in mail and leather with a black bear of House Mormont on shield and surcoat. By Catelyn's lights, that was queer garb for a lady, yet Daisy and Lady Mage seemed more comfortable, both as warriors and as women, than ever the girl from Tarth had been.
"I have fought beside the young wolf in every battle," Daisy Mormont said cheerfully. "He has not lost one yet."
"No, but he's lost everything else," Catelyn thought. But it would not do to say it aloud. The Northmen did not lack for courage, but they were far from home, with little enough to sustain them but for their faith in their young king. That faith must be protected at all costs. "I must be stronger," she told herself. "I must be strong for Rob. If I despair, my grief will consume me." Everything would turn on this marriage. If Edmure and Rosalind were happy in one another, if the late Lord Frey could be appeased and his power once more wedded to Rob's, even then, what chance will we have, caught between Lannister and Greyjoy? It was a question Catelyn dared not dwell on, though Rob dwelt on little else. She saw how he studied his maps whenever they made camp, searching for some plan that might win back the North. Her brother Edmure had other cares. "You don't suppose all Lord Walder's daughters look like him, do you?" he wondered, as he sat in his tall, striped pavilion with Catelyn and his friends. "With so many different mothers, a few of the maids are bound to turn up comely," said Sir Mark Piper. "But why should the old wretch give ye a pretty one?" "No reason at all," said Edmure in a glum tone. It was more than Catelyn could stand. "Cersei Lannister is comely," she said sharply. "You'd be wiser to pray that Rosalind is strong and healthy, with a good head and a loyal heart." And with that she left them. Edmure did not take that well. The next day he avoided her entirely on the march, preferring the company of Mark Piper, Lyman Goodbrook, Patrick Mallister, and the young Vances. "They do not scold him, except in jest," Catelyn told herself, when they raced by her that afternoon with nary a word. "I have always been too hard with Edmure, and now grief sharpens my every word." She regretted her rebuke. There was rain enough falling from the sky without her making more. And was it really such a terrible thing to want a pretty wife? She remembered her own childish disappointment the first time she had laid eyes on Eddard Stark. She had pictured him as a younger version of his brother, Brandon. But that was wrong. Ned was shorter and plainer of face, and so somber. He spoke courteously enough, but beneath the words she sensed a coolness that was all at odds with Brandon, whose mirth had been as wild as his rages. Even when he took her maidenhood, their love had more of duty to it than of passion. We made Rob that night, though. We made a king together. And after the war, at Winterfell, I had love enough for any woman, once I found the good sweetheart beneath Ned's solemn face. There is no reason Edmure should not find the same with his Roslyn. As the gods would have it, their route took them through the Whispering Wood, where Rob had won his first great victory. They followed the course of the twisting stream on the floor of that pinched narrow valley, much as Jaime Lannister's men had done that fateful night. It was warmer then, Catelyn remembered. The trees were still green, and the stream did not overflow its banks. Fallen leaves choked the flow now and lay in sudden snarls among the rocks and roots, and the trees that had once hidden Rob's army had exchanged their green raiment for leaves of dull gold spotted with brown, and a red that reminded her of rust and dry blood. Only the spruce and the soldier pines still showed green, thrusting up at the belly of the clouds like tall dark spears. More than the trees have died since then, she reflected. On the night of the Whispering Wood, Ned was still alive in his cell beneath Aegon's high hill. Bran and Rickon were safe behind the walls of Winterfell. And Theon Greyjoy fought at Rob's side and boasted of how he had almost crossed swords with the Kingslayer. Would that he had. If Theon had died in place of Lord Carstark's sons, how much ill would have been undone. As they passed through the battleground, Catelyn glimpsed signs of the carnage that had been. An overturned helm filled with rain, a splintered lance, the bones of a horse. Stone cairns had been raised over some of the men who had fallen here, but scavengers had already been at them. Amidst the tumbles of rock, she spied brightly coloured cloth and bits of shiny metal. Once she saw a face peering out at her, the shape of the skull beginning to emerge beneath the melting brown flesh. It made her wonder where Ned had come to rest. The Silent Sisters had taken his bones north, escorted by Hallis Mollen and a small honour guard. Had Ned ever reached Winterfell, to be interred beside his brother Brandon in the dark crypts beneath the castle? Or did the door slam shut at Moat Cailin before Hal and the sisters could pass? 3,500 riders wound their way along the valley floor through the heart of the Whispering Wood, but Catelyn Stark had seldom felt lonelier. Every league she crossed took her farther from Riverrun, and she found herself wondering whether she would ever see the castle again, or was it lost to her forever, like so much else? 5 days later, their scouts rode back to warn them that the rising waters had washed out the wooden bridge at Fairmarket. Gorbert Glover and two of his bolder men had tried swimming their mounts across the turbulent Blue Fork at Ramsford. Two of the horses had been swept under and drowned, and one of the riders. Glover himself managed to cling to a rock until they could pull him in. "The river hasn't run this high since spring," Edmure said, "and if this rain keeps falling, it will go higher yet." "There's a bridge further upstream near Oldstones," remembered Catelyn, who had often crossed these lands with her father. "It's older and smaller, but if it still stands..."
"It's gone, my lady," Gorbert Glover said. "Washed away, even before the one at Fairmarket."
Rob looked to Catelyn. "Is there another bridge?" "No. And the fords will be impassable." She tried to remember. "If we cannot cross the Blue Fork, we'll have to go round it, through Seven Streams and Hag's Mire." "Bugs and bad roads, or none at all," warned Edmure.
"The going will be slow. But we'll get there, I suppose."
"Lord Waldo will wait, I'm sure," said Rob. "Lothar sent him a bird from Riverrun. He knows we are coming."
"Yes, but the man is prickly
and suspicious by nature, said Catelyn. He may take this delay as a deliberate insult.
Very well. I'll beg his pardon for our tardiness as well.
A sorry king I'll be, apologizing with every second breath. Rob made a wry face. I hope Bolton got across the Trident before the rains began. The king's road runs straight north. He'll have an easy march. Even afoot, he should reach the twins before us.
And when you've joined his men to yours and seen my brother married, what then? Catelyn asked him.
North.
Rob scratched Grey Wind behind an ear. By the causeway, against Moat Cailin? He gave her an enigmatic smile.
That's one way to go, he said, and she knew from his tone that he would say no more.
A wise king keeps his own counsel, she reminded herself. They reached Oldstones after 8 more days of steady rain and made their camp upon the hill overlooking the Blue Fork, within a ruined stronghold of the ancient River Kings. Its foundations remained amongst the weeds to show where the walls and keeps had stood. But the local small folk had long ago made off with most of the stones to raise their barns and septs and holdfasts. Yet in the centre of what once would have been the castle's yard, a great carved sepulchre still rested, half hidden in waist-high brown grass amongst a stand of ash. The lid of the sepulchre had been carved into the likeness of the man whose bones lay beneath, but the rain and the wind had done their work. The king had worn a beard, they could see, but otherwise his face was smooth and featureless, with only vague suggestions of a mouth, a nose, eyes, and the crown about his temples. His hands folded over the shaft of a stone war hammer that lay upon his chest. Once the war hammer would have been carved with runes that told its name and history, but all that the centuries had worn away. The stone itself was cracked and crumbling at the corners, discoloured here and there by spreading white splotches of lichen, while wild roses crept up over the king's feet almost to his chest. It was there that Catelyn found Rob, standing sombre in the gathering dusk, with only a grey wind beside him. The rain had stopped for once, and he was bareheaded.
"Does this castle have a name?" he asked quietly, when she came up to him.
"Oldstones, all the small folk called it when I was a girl, but no doubt it had some other name when it was still a hall of kings. She had camped here once with her father, on their way to Seagard. Pataya was with us too. There's a song, he remembered. Jenny of Oldstones, with the flowers in her hair.
We're all just songs in the end, if we are lucky. She had played at being Jenny that day, had even wound flowers in her hair, and Pataya had pretended to be her prince of dragonflies. Catelyn could not have been more than 12, Pataya just a boy.
Rob studied the sepulchre. Whose grave is this?
Here lies Tristopher, the fourth of his name, king of the rivers and the hills. Her father had told her his story once. He ruled from the Trident to the Neck, thousands of years before Jenny and her prince, in the days when the kingdoms of the first men were falling one after the other before the onslaught of the Andals. The Hammer of Justice, they called him. He fought 100 battles and won 99, or so the singers say, and when he raised this castle, it was the strongest in Westeros. She put a hand on her son's shoulder. He died in his 100th battle, when 7 Andal kings joined forces against him. The 5th, Tristopher, was not his equal, and soon the kingdom was lost, and then the castle, and last of all, the line. With Tristopher the 5th died House Mud, that had ruled the Riverlands for 1,000 years before the Andals came. His heir failed him. Rob ran a hand over the rough, weathered stone. I had hoped to leave Jane with child. We tried often enough, but I'm not certain. It does not always happen the first time, though it did with you. Nor even the 100th. You are very young. Young and a king, he said. A king must have an heir. If I should die in my next battle, the kingdom must not die with me. By law, Sansa is next in line of succession, so Winterfell and the North would pass to her. His mouth tightened. To her, and her lord husband, Tyrion Lannister. I cannot allow that. I will not allow that. That dwarf must never have the North. No, Catelyn agreed. You must name another heir until such time as Jane gives you a son. She considered for a moment. Your father's father had no siblings, but his father had a sister who married a younger son of Lord Raymar Royce, of the junior branch. They had three daughters, all of whom wed Vale lordlings, a Wainwood and a Corbray for certain. The youngest, it might have been a Templeton, but... Mother, there was a sharpness in Rob's tone. You forget. My father had four sons. She had not forgotten. She had not wanted to look at it. Yet there it was. A Snow is not a Stark. John's more a Stark than some lordlings from the Vale who have never so much as set eyes on Winterfell. John is a brother of the Night's Watch, sworn to take no wife and hold no lands. Those who take the black serve for life. So do the knights of the King's Guard. That did not stop the Lannisters from stripping the white cloaks from Sir Barristan Selmy and Sir Boris Blunt, when they had no more use for them. If I send the watch, 100 men in John's place, I'll wager they'll find some way to release him from his vows. He is set on this. Catelyn knew how stubborn her son could be. A bastard cannot inherit. Not unless he is legitimized by a royal decree, said Rob. There is more precedent for that than for releasing a sworn brother from his oath. Precedent? She said bitterly. Yes, Aegon IV legitimized all his bastards on his deathbed. And how much pain, grief, war, and murder grew from that. I know you trust John, but can you trust his sons, or their sons? The Blackfyre pretenders troubled the Tregarians for 5 generations, until Barristan the Bold slew the last of them on the Stepstones. If you make John legitimate, there is no way to turn him bastard again. Should he wed and breed, any sons you may have by Jane will never be safe. John would never harm a son of mine. No more than Theon Greyjoy would harm Bran or Rickon. Greywind leapt up atop King Tristopher's crypt, his teeth bared. Rob's own face was cold. That is as cruel as it is unfair. John is no Theon. So you pray. Have you considered your sisters? What of their rights? I agree that the North must not be permitted to pass to the imp. But what of Arya? By law, she comes after Sansa, your own sister, true-born. And dead. No one has seen or heard of Arya since they cut father's head off. Why do you lie to yourself? Arya's gone, the same as Bran and Rickon. And they'll kill Sansa, too, once the dwarf gets a child from her. John is the only brother that remains to me. Should I die without issue, I want him to succeed me as king in the North. I had hoped you would support my choice. I cannot, she said. In all else, Rob, in everything, but not in this folly. Do not ask it. I don't have to. I'm the king. Rob turned and walked off, Grey Wind bounding down from the tomb and loping after him. What have I done? Catelyn thought wearily, as she stood alone by Tristopher's stone sepulchre. First I anger Edmure, and now Rob. But all I have done is speak the truth. Are men so fragile? They cannot bear to hear it? She might have wept then, had not the sky begun to do it for her. It was all she could do to walk back to her tent and sit there in the silence. In the days that followed, Rob was everywhere and anywhere, riding at the head of the van with a great John, scouting with Grey Wind, racing back to Robin Flint and the rear guard. Men said proudly that the young wolf was the first to rise each dawn and the last to sleep at night. But Catlin wondered whether he was sleeping at all. He grows as lean and hungry as his direwolf.
"My lady," Maje Mormont said to her one morning as they rode through a steady rain, "you seem so somber. Is aught amiss?"
"My lord husband is dead, as is my father. Two of my sons have been murdered. My daughter has been given to a faithless dwarf to bear his vile children. My other daughter has vanished and likely dead, and my last son and my only brother are both angry with me. What could possibly be amiss?" That was more truth than Lady Maje would wish to hear, however. "This is an evil reign," she said instead. "We have suffered much, and there is more peril and more grief ahead. We need to face it boldly, with horns blowing and banners flying bravely. But this rain beats us down. The banners hang limp and sodden, and the men huddle under their cloaks and scarcely speak to one another. Only an evil rain would chill our hearts when most we need them to burn hot." Daisy Mormont looked up at the sky.
"I would sooner have water raining down on me than arrows."
Catlin smiled despite herself. "You are braver than I fear.
Are all your Bear Island women such warriors?"
"She bears, I," said Lady Maje. "We have needed to be. In olden days the Iron Men would come raiding in their longboats or wildlings from the frozen shore. The men would be off fishing, like as not. The wives they left behind had to defend themselves and their children, or else be carried off." "There's a carving on our gate," said Daisy. "A woman in a bearskin with a child in one arm suckling at her breast. In the other hand she holds a battle-axe. She's no proper lady, that one, but I always loved her."
"My nephew Jorah brought home a proper lady once," said Lady Maje. "He won her in a tourney. How she hated that carving."
"Aye, and all the rest," said Daisy. "She had hair like spun gold, that Lyness. Skin like cream, but her soft hands were never made for axes."
"Nor her tits for giving suck," her mother said bluntly.
Catlin knew of whom they spoke. Jorah Mormont had brought his second wife to Winterfell for feasts, and once they had guested for a fortnight. She remembered how young the Lady Lyness had been, how fair, and how unhappy. One night, after several cups of wine, she had confessed to Catlin that the north was no place for a high tower of Old Town. "There was a Tully of River Run who felt the same once," she had answered gently, trying to console. But in time, she found much here she could love. All lost now, she reflected. Winterfell and Ned, Bran and Rickon, Sansa, Arya, all gone. Only Rob remains. Had there been too much Lyness Hightower in her, after all, and too little of the Starks? Would that I had known how to wield an axe. Perhaps I might have been able to protect them better. Day followed day, and still the rain kept falling. All the way up the Blue Fork they rode, past seven streams where the river unravelled into a confusion of rills and brooks, then through Hagsmire, where glistening green pools waited to swallow the unwary, and the soft ground sucked at the hooves of their horses like a hungry babe at its mother's breast. The going was worse than slow. Half the wains had to be abandoned to the muck, their loads distributed amongst mules and draft horses. Lord Jason Mallister caught up with them amidst the bugs of Hagsmire. There was more than an hour of daylight remaining when he rode up with his column, but Rob called a halt at once. and Sir Reynard Westerling came to escort Catelyn to the king's tent. She found her son seated beside a brazier, a map across his lap. Grey Wynne slept at his feet.